and gentlemen, it's the Stephanie Miller Show.
Good morning, it's the Stephanie Miller Show. I'm Hal Sparks, filling in for Steph and the Mooks while they're away on vacation and having a great time doing it. The fires are 25% controlled here in Los Angeles. We're making steady progress. They are using a giant 747 to dump water on them now, and I feel much safer because of that, knowing that there's an enormous plane filled to the gills with water flying back and forth over my neighborhood. That's great. A lot of news today, and I do want to cover the Tom Ridge, Rachel Maddow interview where Rachel really laid the smackdown on Tom Ridge on a couple of very important fronts, which I think has been an argument that a lot of progressives have been making for a very long time, you know, about the Iraq War. And we'll get to that in a second. But I have to take a moment to nerd out for 1 second. I just came across, probably from a space nerd and a math nerd point of view, the coolest, this is a game changer, kids. This is a game changer on all fronts. CNN is reporting that electronics such as phones and laptops may start shedding their power cords within a year. We are headed towards wireless electricity. That's right. That's the prediction of Eric Geiler, I believe it is, CEO of Y-tricity, a company that's able to power light bulbs using wireless electricity that travels several feet from a power socket. There's been a lot of talk about wireless energy for a long time. And of course, nerds like me who are big fans of Nikola Tesla and the band Tesla, for that matter, have been wondering out loud for a very long time about where the wireless energy is. Because even on low levels, it's, you know, they've been talking about the possibility of it for decades. But now it looks like it's actually here. And there, he's actually quoted. By the way, his company is a spinoff of an MIT research group, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, here in America. He says it has the potential to cut the need for power cords and throw away batteries. This is the big thing. He goes, 5 years from now, this will seem completely normal. This is the, you know, what iPods did to the music industry, wireless electricity will do for, I believe, electric cars. This is the big shift. Everybody's been wondering, how do we make electric cars? Because you got to charge the thing, and how much will the batteries hold, and what do you do with the waste of the batteries? But if you've got a power line running down the center of all of our major streets, you don't need that anymore. Cars run on a certain level of this wireless energy. It's a whole different setup. This changes everything, and I'm sorry if I'm nerding out too heavily, but I think this is huge. American technology, which I think is very important, and American scientific technology. You know, it's amazing how once we started bailing out car companies, all of a sudden they started tripping a switch, and suddenly we have all this wonderful, you know, they went from, we could never build a car. Look, we tried to make an electric car. And it's got a 20-mile range, and it makes weird noises, and it smells. That's the best we can do. So just be happy with diesel. You know, we just can't do it. And then, oh, we're going out of business. We need government money. Okay, you can have all this government money, but you have to improve your cars. You have to improve your efficiency and their mileage and stuff. Like, oh, yeah, no, we can do that. Look at this car. It's got 360-mile radius on a single charge. Wait, where have you been keeping that thing? Please do not. I can't believe, money is a great motivator, but it doesn't motivate innovation, you know. To quote Dr. Hathaway in Real Genius, you can't dictate innovation, Don. Therefore, you know, anyways, this is fascinating to me. So it's on CNN.com/technology, their page. I think it's huge, and I'm going to nerd about it all morning. Now, on to Tom Ridge and the Rachel Maddow interview. I want to play – Tom Ridge, of course, got a lot of attention because he just put out his autobiography. And to to raise the publicity level of it. Basically this whole book is 2 pages long. There's a lot of stuff in there, but the two major pages that everybody seems to be focusing on is when he said he was sitting in a meeting with Donald Rumsfeld and his ilk during these national security meetings, and they were trying to get the threat level raised in ways that benefited the Bush administration. Specifically, the one he notes is the right before the 2004 election, which he said they refused to do, and then magically this Osama bin Laden tape comes out, and then it gets raised anyways. So I'm going to play them a little bit out of order just so you can it's interesting. Keep in mind, Tom Ridge suggests in these two pages that this is what, you know, this is what happened. This is what the Bush administration made a case for raising the threat level so that it could benefit them politically. He makes that case very soundly, I think. And then Rachel kind of brings that up, and this is his response. It's track 4, Tony.
I think you're suggesting that it was driven by, quite obviously, the people who made the decision knew more about the threat than you and I do. And again, I think it's a pretty radical conclusion to suggest that men and women entrusted with the safety of this country would predicate a decision upon any other basis other than to keep America safe.
But that's the suggestion he's making in his book. That's the funny thing. As soon as Rachel brings it up and sort of paints it in stark relief, all of a sudden he's backpedaling rather heavily from this. And Rachel, I think this is the most direct I've ever heard her deal with it. She's very businesslike about it. She's very remains very calm, although you can hear her at one point, and I'll play the clip for you in a second, tapping on the desk and pointing at the book when she's kind of, I think, losing her patience with how he's said this in his book. It's such a factor of the book that they sell it on the website that way, and it's in the flap on the inside of the book, which you, by the way, as an author, I have a lot of friends who've written books. You get clearance on all that stuff. You have to sign off on it, you or your agent. And when you're writing an autobiography, it's you. You look over it. And if you didn't see what was written there, it's because you had no reason to believe it would disagree with the content. And seldom does it. You know, it doesn't really help you to sell a book with what's not in it. So here goes. And Rachel responds, I think, to the idea that Republicans. Well, here we'll play track 2. Actually, give me track 2.
I have to tell you, I think I think you making that argument right now is why Republicans after the Bush and Cheney administration are not going to get back the country's trust on national security. To look back at that decision and say, we got it wrong, but it was in good faith, and not acknowledge the foregone conclusion that we were going to invade Iraq that pervaded every decision that was made about intelligence. Looking back at that decision-making process, it sounds like you're making the argument you would have made the same decision again. Americans need to believe that our government would not make that wrong a decision. That would not make such a foregone take such a foregone conclusion to such an important issue that the intelligence that proved the opposite point was all discounted, that the intelligence was combed through for any bit that would support the foregone conclusion of the policymakers. The system was broken, and if you don't see that the system was broken and you think it was just that the intel was wrong, I think that you're one of the most trusted voices on national security for the Republican Party, and I think that's the elephant in the room.
Yeah. Wow. And you can see, this is where she started, you could hear it starting to tap on the table. Because he was so, here's the argument that he was making, and I think, this is the legacy argument that a lot of the people who were in the Bush administration continue to make, which is that, we did the best with what we had at the time, which is the, you can almost give some leeway in that argument. I don't believe it. I think they manufactured the evidence. I think the Downing Street memo and a lot of their evidence points to the fact that they manipulated their reasons and their evidence for going into the Iraq war. But even if you give someone complete innocence and go, this is all the information I had and I went with that. Now, that still doesn't sell you on the point that his next argument, which is, she goes, knowing what you know now, would you still have made this decision? And he says, yes, because, if it shows that, there's some kind of a democracy in Iraq eventually, that, you know, it will have been worth it. And so they keep making this. The secondary argument is always the tough one, that yes, I would have made that same decision now, which is the equivalent of someone who's in an abusive relationship saying, I want to go back to them, or I would still go out with this person. Knowing now what I know, I would still get in a relationship with this person is sort of absurd and points to an illness on the part of the person on that side of the relationship, that you have a fixation with that portion. And these guys love the idea of going to war in Iraq so much and also have to do so much CYA that they're just stuck that way. So they refuse to look back and go, this was a mistake. The Iraq war was fundamentally a mistake. We should have never been in there. There was no particular reason to do this. There were other ways to disarm this man or keep him, keep us safe while keeping him from, reaching his goals, through containment. It had been working for a decade. He had not developed any kind of weapons of mass destruction. We knew this. The inspectors on the ground knew this. We never found anything. Exactly like they said, we're not going to find anything. That being said, they still hang to it as if they did find something. It's no surprise that the birthers and the deathers and those folks still believe there's stuff hidden. There's still stuff. They believe that somehow the stuff was moved to Syria. It was hidden and carried across the borders, and Iran is helping. That kind of idea. Anyways, so she goes to I think the most the strongest point towards that track three.
I don't think you guys get back your credibility on national security until you realize that was a wrong decision made by policymakers. It wasn't the spies' fault.
Because they're constantly saying that it was faulty intelligence. Cheney was making that argument yesterday, and then I guess in the big Jonas Brothers Chris Wallace interview that he gave, it's stunning. They just want to hold on to that till the very end, because if that falls apart, their entire political POV falls apart. It's kind of, it's the same thing of asking them about their economic policies. If you ask them about their economic policies and the tax breaks for the rich that they gave away very specifically and those kind of things, they'll still argue that it was great, even though the entire economy tanked on their watch. Even though 9/11 happened on their watch, they'll still argue that they're the best on national security. And it's absurd beyond measure. Before I go, I want to play the last track on there. Give me six.
You can go back in time and sell the American people on the idea that 4,000 Americans ought to live their lives and we ought to lose those trillions of dollars for democracy in Iraq. You have a wilder imagination than I do.
Yeah, you have a wilder imagination than I do. It's amazing how they'll hold on to that and somehow try to find a way that make sense. In the same way that they'll talk about how Khalid Sheikh Mohammed actually gave up actionable intelligence without being tortured for two whole days, and then he shut up when we started beating him, and then after we stopped beating him, he started giving lectures on how Al Qaeda made plans. And it's almost like the equivalent of, my sister dated a guy who beat her and now she's pregnant. And I think it's the beatings that got her pregnant. That's the logic is so fundamentally flawed. And yet they cling to it so much. But then I guess what else are you going to do when, the driving forces right now in your argument are Rush Limbaugh and Glenn Beck and Dick Cheney. These are the three main voices of the Republican Party. And they're all beyond crazy. After I come back from the break, I'm going to play you a little bit of stuff. It's deep end is not even the word for it. I don't even think they're spelunking in the deep end. Anyways, I'm Hal Sparks. I'm filling in for Stephanie while she's away on vacation, and I hope they're having a wonderful time. By the way, coming up later in the show, Jim Ward is going to be calling in, and we're going to congratulate him for his Emmy that he won earlier in the week. And then, we just got a lot of stuff. So we'll come back right after this. 1-800-STEP-12 is our number. It's the Stephanie Miller Show.
This is not normal.
It's the Stephanie Miller Show.
It's the Stephanie Miller Show. I'm Hal Sparks, filling in for Steph and the Mooks while they're away on vacation. It's a good feeling. It's nice to be here in sunny, fiery California. Sitting in for Steph while she's away on vacation, being dipped in some sort of, what is it, night skin? Is that what they do? I forget. Do they sell that on here? I think so. Yeah. I mean, that stuff is amazing, I think. In Hollywood, you know, they sell it across the country so people can wipe it on their faces and that kind of stuff before they go to sleep at night. And makes, you know, it takes 10 years, you know, it sends you back in time or something. It makes your head look like it was in high school and the rest of your body looks like it's in 5 years in the future. I don't know how that works. I'm sure it's terrific. But they have spas here where they dip you in it, you know, like C-3PO getting an oil bath, you know. This night skin will feel so good, you know. Anyways, I don't know how it works. And I don't even pretend to. That's my version of crazy. That's as crazy as I get, just goofing around. But Glenn Beck, man. He's cornering the market on crazy. Now, I personally think that he's the dangerous kind of crazy, the mentally ill kind of crazy, and I think that's, you know, the not cute kind, the unsafe kind. But he does have his cute moments. I will give him that. You know, there are times when he's fomenting violence and he's calling the president a racist and he's saying that, if you die with honor, it's, you know, it's a good death. You know, I want to play a couple of clips. Glenn went off yesterday. He apparently, in tooling around Rockefeller Center with his wife, spotted all kinds of communist propaganda in all the artwork in Rockefeller Center, put there by, of course, Rockefeller, that great communist who ran Standard Oil, that horrible communist organization that really cared more about the workers and the people than it did about making money. Anyways, let's play track. By the way, for those of you who go, I don't understand what he's talking about. Don't expect to. On his show, he's pointing at artwork and pointing out the details in it to try and tell you where the communist propaganda is. Here we go.
Rockefeller had Standard Oil. That's how he made all of his money. Well, Standard Oil had this big Gothic building downtown in New York, and they wanted to change it and update it. And there was no real American architecture in New York City, in the whole world. They decided to do something completely different, streamlined, different.
Yeah, so that was his first big plan when he was going to, he was going to make his big impact. Was he's, you know, Rockefeller is his big first communist move, streamlined architecture. That should tell you something. That big commie streamlined. Play the next clip. It's not going to make any more sense than the last one, but go ahead.
Here's the door frame of this building. This is where the concerts are. There's this man and this man. Well, let's see. He's holding a hammer, and there's weed over there, so this must be the worker.
Yes, there's a guy with a hammer and wheat. We don't have time to play this. I've got, after I come back from the break, we've got Representative Javier Becerra is going to be with us to talk about health insurance reform. But later in the hour, we'll be getting more of this. And I really want the callers to try and figure out what you think he's trying to say. Now, I know some people actually listen and know what Glenn Beck is up to. I'm not one of them. I'm Hal Sparks. I'm filling in for Stephanie Miller on The Stephanie Miller Show, 1-800-STEPH-12. We'll be right back.
And thanks for playing.
The Stephanie Miller Show. I'm Hal Sparks. 1-800-STEPH-12 is our number. I just played a bunch of Glenn Beck crazy talk, and we will do more of that after this next segment. But I really want to shift the argument from crazy to sane. I know it's a drastic shift, but I know that you'll do. But I'm lucky enough to have on the phone Representative Javier Becerra with me. Representative, are you there?
Hal, I'm with you.
Terrific.
And I think I'm with you in more ways than you know.
Well, thank you, sir. I certainly hope so. I mean, judging from your position on healthcare, I think we're definitely in the same deep end of the pool, as it were, unafraid to deal. And by the way, I want people to know that you've been working on a guide for seniors that explains the, you know, healthcare reform, correct?
That's absolutely correct. We're going to be introducing it today.
That's great. And I think, you know, that's one of the groups that's been hit the hardest by the misinformation campaign. And by the way, I don't think that was a mistake. I think you know, when you've got a younger generation that gets largely, you know, gets a lot of their news from the Daily Show and the internet and stays up on things in a moment-to-moment kind of Twitter level, I think the only it's harder and harder to pull the wool over their eyes because there's too many options for them. But the older generation still sticks to traditional news formats. And in some cases stays on one channel. I won't say what that channel is, but they'll stay on one channel all the time, and not get an alternate point of view.
And think of it, Hal, our senior population is the population most in need of health care, the one that most uses health care, so the one that has most at stake if we make any bad or wrong changes to health care.
That's true. And also are the easiest to frighten.
That's right.
Because, quite frankly, you start getting up in that age and things about your body start to scare you because you're not out of the blue. You don't seem as resilient or as healthy as you used to be. And that's not just a shock to your physical system. It's a shock psychologically as well. And so people feel very vulnerable, especially in this area.
Let me tell you, I'm already scared of my body, and so if in 10, 20 years when I'm a senior, I'm going to be more scared. You've got me frightened now.
Well, yeah, that's my goal. You know, I learned that from Glenn Beck. I just kind of I just spook people, I don't give any answers, and I run away.
But you're absolutely right. This is one of those areas where if you say it enough times, it begins to sound like the truth, mm-hmm. and people begin to accept it as the truth. And unfortunately, just as we heard with these death panels that a lot of opponents of health care reform were out there spouting, mm-hmm. The euthanasia claim, all those things have now been disproven. It was clearly a lie, but they plan to deceive, to raise the doubt in the minds of a lot of people. And who is most concerned about euthanasia death panels? Someone who's getting on in years.
Right. And also feeling like, you know, their years of productivity are behind them, and therefore, you know, their worth level, you know, their own psychological view of themselves gets lower because we have such a focus on, you know, being, you know, having a job, working, doing things. They say that most people, you know, after they retire, their life expectancy drops very quickly because, you know, we all have that sense of purpose that gets us up in the morning. When you're much older and you've been retired for a little while in a couple of years, it's much easier to go, you know, to have someone scare you in this, and they've taken advantage of that. The other side, I think, also is just it's ironic to me that the red states that per capita have more uninsured people have the biggest instances of these you know, birthers and deathers showing up at these town halls and shouting down the argument for health care reform when they would probably benefit from it the most.
That's the irony here, is that the folks who seem to be opposing real reform the most happen to reside in areas that need it the most.
Mm-hmm. And I just so we know, like from your point of view, what do you think are the most crucial points of healthcare reform?
If you're going to base your reform on an existing system, and the president made that decision that we should base it on the employer-based system because 165 million Americans currently get their insurance through their employer, then what you have to do is make sure that the employee, the worker, has choices, because one of the things that's driven up costs is the fact that we don't have any choice.
Mm-hmm.
You're stuck. If someone says, I'll give you insurance, but you have to pay this much, we can't go out there and say, wait a minute, I'm going to go somewhere else. You have no real choice, and as a result, you're stuck. Mm-hmm. The leverage is all with the insurer. And so if you're going to base it on employment to get your insurance, then you have to give people real choices. And so the more people can pick and choose, the more real competition will take place, where insurers say, wait a minute, I'm going to lose this customer if I don't reduce my rates or offer better benefits. And so choice is crucial. Once you start offering choice, then more people get into the system because they have better choices to select from and can afford to buy the coverage. So the most important thing you can do is create real competition so that people can have meaningful choices. Then guess what? Quality starts to improve, because after you match some insurer's prices for health benefits, the difference then becomes, well, the quality of care I get out of this insurance policy is better than the providers that are under this insurance policy. So
right.
Quality starts to improve as well.
Right. Well, and I think that's the solution for getting people in, which I think is a crucial part of this or whatever. And then the other half of it being, how do we keep them from getting kicked out?
Yeah.
Once they get ill, and once illness strikes or an injury happens, and talk about that as far as the other part of this legislation, which is about regulating insurance.
Yeah, it's all about discrimination. It's all about cherry picking, mm-hmm. and that's what the insurance industry has been free to do for decades. They get to pick who they want to cover, and so if you want coverage, you have to pay a whole lot more than your neighbor. I talk to women in America; they pay more for health insurance today than do men who are in the same condition health-wise, same age, same income. Same geographic living circumstance. Guess what? A woman will always end up paying more than a man does. This legislation prohibits that type of discrimination. You're going to switch jobs. An insurance company says, sorry, I'm not going to insure you if you're going to go live somewhere else. Well, we prohibit that type of discrimination based on movement. And so portability becomes very important. We talked about pre-existing conditions. You all of a sudden you find out, hey, I have diabetes. Boom, all of a sudden your insurer says, guess what, we're not going to cover you anymore. They can just do that. They can just drop you.
Right.
And so we would prohibit in this legislation an insurance company really just on its own deciding to drop you from its coverage or to charge you more simply because you have a pre-existing condition. We can do that because if everyone's in the system, then you give insurers what they need, and that is volume. The way insurance works, if I have to insure you against death, if I have a million of you to insure, I can sort of spread my risk. But if it's only one person, I don't have much risk to spread. And so that's why we can go ahead and prohibit insurance companies from doing this discrimination, because we're giving them 40 to 50 million new customers.
Well, and we also have, I was making this point yesterday. We get, we have an impetus to focus on prevention and wellness much more when we all have a bit of the shared burden. There's the social pressure towards health shifts more dramatically in a positive sense when the average person's tax dollars, it's the same thing to some degree when people realize that we all pay for litter pickup on our freeways. We have a different feeling when we know that about somebody throwing something out of the window of their car than we do if we don't. If we don't think we're paying for it. Now that we know that we'll be not only, I think I'm for a public option. I think it's a necessity in this. But also if you have a larger, group of insurance companies and we are trying to create a larger pool to draw from. Everybody has I don't want my premiums going up, and this is one of the ways to mitigate costs is we all need to be healthier.
That's right. If you provide preventative services, we know that you'll be healthier down the road, and that means we'll have to spend less to make sure that you stay well in the future. So it's just a smart thing to do, but we've always been in this country penny-wise and pound-foolish when it comes to health care. Finally, this legislation flips that on its head and says, no. Now we're going to be smart at up front. I remember that commercial. I think it was in the auto mechanic who said, you can pay me now or you can pay me later.
Right.
We should do a little bit of penny payment now because it costs cents to provide prevention. That'll save us dollars, big dollars in the future. So prevention is critical. And this legislation would require that any insurer that wants to participate in this marketplace or this exchange to offer insurance coverage to those Americans who would be able to qualify must provide a policy that would provide preventative benefits and at no cost for children. So low cost for adults, no cost for children.
Well, I think one of the reasons women traditionally also have higher premiums is because they make use of the wellness aspect anyways, because women are much better than men at going when they feel ill and taking care of things when they happen. So it does create, more of a smaller cost, but they also live longer, probably in direct relation to that.
That's right.
And so I think it could be a tremendously positive shift in the wellness of America if we start taking a look at these costs and how much of it is personally accrued, and then we all have a social network aspect of where we're looking at each other going, man, you got to start working out, you got to start eating better, you got to start taking care of yourself, you can't smoke like that, because we're all in this together.
That's it. And then when you package all of that together in this reform with the option for folks to be able, as you mentioned before, to buy into an insurance plan that's like Medicare, public option, then what you've done is you've given people this variety of choices, But there's also a plan, the public option, like Medicare, that keeps all the insurers honest because they might decide to collude. Hey, how much are you going to offer your preventative care services for? Or what's your, what are you going to sell that
price fixing,
for?
Right.
Yeah, well, the government's saying, wait, I don't have to pay my CEO $20 million this year.
Right.
And so I don't have to worry about charging $5 for one aspirin tablet at the hospital. And so guess what? Medicare-like plans get to keep their costs low. They get to pass on the savings to their customers. So anyone who's enrolled in a Medicare-like plan will probably be paying lower premiums, lower copays, and lower out-of-pocket costs long-term. And guess what? And if an insurance company wants to compete, they'll have to become leaner and a lot sleeker in trying to offer people services.
Right, absolutely. And one of the ways that America gains profit from our own public system is a healthier citizenry.
Absolutely.
You know, which is a benefit you can't put a dollar sign on. You know, you can look at the medical establishment and say, you know, there's a lot of money coming through hospitals, let's say, and you know, and they're gaining profit, but if those profits come from something that has a net negative on the society as a whole, in that, you know, liposuction doesn't, you know, is not necessarily a sign that things are better. You know, it sure, money is passing from one place to another, but it doesn't point to health or growth. I think it's just a healthier direction. I think this could move us in. It's you know, beyond the economic aspect of it. I think this part of the conversation is how do we all live longer and better and in a more healthful way.
You've mentioned all the reasons why we must do health care reform. Anyone who talks about just saying no, they're just in denial. They're not.
And they have been for decades.
For decades. And or either they're in denial or they've got a vested interest in keeping the system the way it is.
Right. Oh, and a cash interest, actually.
Yeah.
I want to thank you so much, Representative Javier Becerra, for coming on. You have a website. Is it your standard kind of house, Becerra.gov?
Becerra.house.gov.
Thank you. Yes, Becerra.house.gov. And that has a link to your guide for seniors that you're going to link to
guide
today.
Guide for seniors. Folks can watch all my recent town hall meetings or listen to my recent telephone town hall meetings. You can be linked to other sites that give you information on not just the legislation, but myths and facts. You name it, you'll get it.
Terrific. Thank you so much. I'm running up against a hard break, and I love this conversation. So hopefully we'll have it again sometime.
Al, good to talk to you.
Thank you very much. Representative Javier Becerra, I got to take a break. I'm Hal Sparks. I'm filling in for Steph while she's away on vacation. 1-800-STEPH-12. Your phone calls after the break and a couple more crazy Glenn Beck clips. And then later in the show, we're going to have Jim Ward on to congratulate him for his Emmy. We'll be right back.
That's the smartest thing I've ever heard anyone say about anything.
It's the Stephanie Miller Show.
Hello, Mr. Fancy.
It's the Stephanie Miller Show. I'm Hal Sparks, filling in while Steph and the Mooks are away on vacation. 1-800-STEPH-12 is our number. Great conversation with Representative Becerra in the last segment. And, of course, coming up in the next little bit, we have our next guest at 7:30 will be Assemblyman John Perez from California. California's first openly gay assemblyman, which is very exciting. And, of course, we've got Jeff Charlotte in the third hour today, the author of The Family, which is a fantastic book on the dominionist right-wing Christian organization that secretly puppet tries to run our government and sometimes succeeds and sometimes fails does most of what it does under the cover of night. Now, I don't want to sound paranoid. That's not what I am about. I've got, you know, I like evidence with my stuff. I'm unlike Glenn Beck. I don't see communists in the woodwork. In case you missed it, let's play these little clips. This is, by the way, this is what happens when Glenn Beck walks through Rockefeller Plaza in New York City with his wife and starts going, Rockefeller was a communist, and it's everywhere. Like, this is when his paranoia has actually moved from just people staring in his window to now concrete is staring at him. He's literally seeing enemies in statues. Okay, let's try four.
Rockefeller had Standard Oil. That's how he made all of his money. Well, Standard Oil had this big Gothic building downtown in New York, and they wanted to change it and update it. And there was no real American architecture in New York City, in the whole world. They decided to do something completely different, streamlined, different.
Different. Ooh, scary different. Yes, because Rockefeller had Standard Oil, big communist organization. Give me five.
Here's the door frame of this building. This is where the concerts are. There's this man and this man. Well, let's see. He's holding a hammer, and there's weed over there, so this must be the worker.
Yeah, he's got on either side of the door frame, there's a guy who's leaning on a sledgehammer. And there's wheat behind him. And then he looks at the other side of the door frame.
This must be the worker. Yes, because he has the hammer here, the worker. Now show me the other door frame. Here's the farmer. Oh, there's the wheat. But what's this? This is a sickle.
A sickle. What? That was the only Russians used sickles. Hammer and a sickle. And they're together. Well, they're not together. They're about 18 feet apart on the other side of these two doors. But and one of them's leaning on a big sledgehammer because the, you know, who cares that the rails were built partly with money from Standard Oil. And but the sickle, man, look at that crazy pointy thing that's, you know, used to cut wheat during, wait, Tony's nodding. We actually had wheat fields here in the United States at that time? They actually used that thing as an implement? Okay. But I think he's right. I think there's a communist conspiracy. Number six, please. Or wait, number seven, sorry.
Gee, the hammer and the sickle. Where has anybody seen that before?
Oh,
you know what? Sure, this is it. This is from Moscow.
Oh, well, that's sure. Of course. The hammer and sickle is in Moscow. It was, you know, that was invented by commies right there. Okay, give me eight. It gets better.
This capitalist had a hammer and a sickle? Had the worker and the farmer just like Moscow on his building? A progressive? I thought they hated communism. They don't ever want to do that. Well, they certainly hate fascism. We know that.
This is what's commonly referred to as sarcasm, which I've often said is what idiots have instead of a sense of humor. that's my favorite. That's actually Glenn Beck's main argument point, by the way, if you notice. They're the two main points where you just exasperatedly say the opposite of what you're thinking, or you just say, which is the, you know, what they do in debate. Okay, so give me nine.
This is a relief. This was actually made by an Italian artist. He did a lot of the artwork here in New York City.
Stop for a second, Tony. This is, by the way, about another piece of art that's a naked man in a chariot being pulled by horses with a little kid running in front of it. And this is what Glenn Beck gathers from this.
This is a relief. This was actually made by an Italian artist. He did a lot of the artwork here in New York City. But let me show you what it is.
And 10. Give me 10 real quick.
Who's in the back here? Let's show you his hand. This man's strong hand is holding on to the reins tightly here, holding back the engines of industry, being led into the bright future of tomorrow by a young boy. Who is this? Who is this? This is the strong leader using that industry and those machines to lead us into the bright future, led by our children. Gee, who's having indoctrination next week? Oh, yeah, that's right, the president. Completely unrelated.
Wow. So it's basically, and the great thing is in this particular relief, it's a nude man on a chariot. It's a classic piece of Roman style, artwork. Nude guy putting a chariot. There's a kid running in front of it. And from this, he gets Mussolini. That he thinks the naked man in the chariot is Mussolini. So, and that the children who are running, presumably, I would look at the thing trying to not get run over by the guy in the chariot with the horses. But no, he sees that the horses represent industry. And that the wheels on the chariot represent the progress, and this guy is holding it back. The leader holds back progress with the reins, and he indoctrinates the children to run ahead of the thing and clear the sunlight out of the way, because that's Obama's plan for solar energy. I guess I didn't realize how prophetic the Greco-Roman architecture and. artwork outside. Anyways, we'll be back with more looniness after this. I'm Hal Sparks filling in for Stephanie Miller. 1-800-STEP-12. It's the Stephanie Miller Show.
and gentlemen, it's the Stephanie Miller Show.
I'm quite sure they will say so.
It's the Stephanie Miller Show. I'm Hal Sparks, filling in for Steph while she's away on vacation, and we're reveling in basking in the glory of all things crazy that is Glenn Beck. For those of you that weren't here last break, I played a couple of clips from the wonderful dissection that he made of the artwork in Rockefeller Plaza. It's just stunning, and for those of you that read The Da Vinci Code and were amazed by the amount of detail and research that went into that book, and then rented National Treasure 2, thinking, well, facts are overrated, let's just make up stuff about the Capitol, that's fun. This is even further down that rabbit hole. This is kind of like, if The Da Vinci Code was a novel and National Treasure was a script, Glenn Beck has written the cocktail napkin of silly art conspiracy theories. It's really stunning. We have a lot of callers on the line who want to do this. I want to actually go to Stephen in Hammond, Indiana, because Stephen says that Glenn Beck's Rockefeller history is off. Is that the case?
As depicted in the 1999 film The Cradle Will Rock, Nelson Rockefeller actually had a very large, expensive mural that he'd commissioned from Mexican artist Diego Rivera, removed from the walls, the wall of Rockefeller Center, with jackhammers.
Right, because it had too much.
Too
much leftist
socialist
figures
in it.
Because it had a big picture of Lenin in it. And it had a big pic. And by the way, I only played you a little bit of what Glenn went into, but he went into, like, this was another segment that he did on that piece of artwork, which is now hanging in a museum, I guess, in Mexico right now. They toured around. But,
oh, really? I was not aware of that.
Yeah, it's still in pieces, but they toured around as a big piece of art. But I believe it's in Mexico City now. But anyways, he's going through this painting, pointing out, look, there's Lenin's face, the hero of the painting. This is Rockefeller. This is who he's, and never going, well, it's not there still, is it? And he got fairly mad, and he goes, and who's here above syphilis in the painting? It's a portrait. He actually says that. He goes, here's disease. This is syphilis, like there's a picture of syphilis.
But he had it removed.
Yeah. He had it removed. And right above above syphilis is a picture of Rockefeller. Like, oh, well, that, sure, that settles it. So I get it. Rockefeller caused syphilis, and that's what brought down the USSR. It's stunning. But thank you for the art lesson that I think is very important to this. I still side with Glenn that Rockefeller was a hard-nosed commie. But cheers. Thanks.
All right.
Thanks. it's pretty, oh, goodness. Let's go to Richard in Long Beach. Richard, you there? Or Ricardo,
yes,
beg your pardon.
Yeah, this is Ricardo.
Hey, Ricardo.
It seems to me that the reason he sounds so crazy is because he truly lives in a different world. And what's interesting is that he is talking to people who do not realize that the Civil War is over. These are people who now here comes a black guy that actually has authority. And
oh, frightening to them. Well, I mean, they talk about liberal guilt all the time. They think that liberals actually are respectful and politically correct towards the disenfranchised or minorities or women or people who have been traditionally out of power. They think we do that out of guilt. I think we do it out of respect and humanity. Right. But I think they act this way out of guilt. I think this is like, on the good sense, they're like, oh, no, it's all the things we did to black people. If one of them gets in charge, you imagine what he's going to do to us?
Because we know what we would do.
Absolutely. I mean, they tell you what they would do. You know, half of the things they go, this is what's coming. I mean, you know, Obama's running their Hitler Youth. They're sitting in the back going, oh, I would love some Hitler Youth. Wouldn't you love some Hitler Youth?
You know what, Hal? The thing is that mentality is reflected on all these other policy fronts, because if you think about healthcare, they are able to look at the fellow citizens and say that it doesn't matter that that person can die because they're sick. There are just some people that don't. If you don't have the money, you don't deserve.
Right,
to
don't
live.
Deserve to make it. I thank you for the call, Ricardo. Absolutely. I had this big Facebook flame war on my Facebook page at one point with when I did a pro healthcare reform post. one of the people who came up against the biggest argument is, look, if you can't afford health care, then, you know, that's your problem. Just simply as that. I mean, that's their moral equivalent there. It's just your, you know, get a job. That's sure. Okay. This is, you know, like Michael Steele yesterday mocking that woman whose mother died, saying that she's only acting up to get attention at a town hall meeting or whatever. Sean in Ithaca, New York. Sean, you there?
I just want to tell you, all people have to do is Google search Dominion theology or Reconstructionist theology.
Right.
They will understand what these people are doing with the Republican Party. And it is all based upon fear. It's never based upon fact. And it's this crazy idea that they have to convert all of us to their version of Christianity, and then Christ can return.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, we've got, by the way, in the next hour, we have Jeff Charlotte, who wrote The Family, The Secret Fundamentalism of the Heart at the Heart of American Power. It very distinctly addresses this and in a very serious way. I think, you know, I'll play another clip in a second. I'm going to let you go because the line is noisy, but I appreciate what you said. I want to play a clip of Glenn Beck freaking out. So Glenn Beck goes on every night, becomes the Reverend Gene Scott meets a Jim Carrey character, and just kind of rambles BS crazy stuff. And then when it comes back to bite him in the butt, when he's getting all these emails, "You're right, Glenn, I bought a gun. I'm headed towards my state capitol right now. I'm texting you from my iPhone." They wouldn't have an iPhone. They wouldn't know how to use it. "I'm texting you from my I don't know how to text. My brother wrote a note on a Post-it note, and he's emailing it from dial-up." That's really what happened. And he wants you to know, Glenn, that I love you, man, and I'm on the way to my federal building with a pickup truck full of manure and a match, that he has to go on the air and stand there and go, "Hey, don't pick up a gun. You know, this is about ideas that I don't," and he has to backpedal so quickly. I think when he backpedals from it, I think his hardcore listeners think he's been bought out and kind of threaten him because he had a little bit of a panic attack. Give me the clown clip, Tony.
"Do you think I want to get on the air every night and tell you this stuff? Do you know who I am? The media will say, 'Oh, he's just a clown.' Well, you know what? I am a clown.
You know, you can tell so much about a person from the way they live. Just looking around here, I can tell you're a genuinely dirty person."
Glenn Beck, I don't want to. "Hey, I don't want to come on the air and tell you this stuff. They poke a gun in my back, make me walk out here. I don't want to play the second half of the clip. It's just,
I am a guy who just I just want to have laughs and fun. I'm a capitalist. I want to make money. I want to do all that stuff. I want to live my life with my family. I don't want to have to live with security and walls and gates and everything else. Do you think I want to live that way?"
Yeah, I think you want to live in a gated community, actually. I think this is where we find out that Glenn Beck just wants to have fun. I think it's a Cyndi Lauper song waiting to happen. "Oh, Glenn just want to have fun." Okay, this is what happens when he spouts this kind of stuff and drives these people, just to be insane and then regrets it when they start, you foment this kind of stuff, the Koreshians start eating their leader, as it were. Let's go to Tom in Chicago, Illinois.
Yeah, I actually got a chance to watch this last night, to watch this idiot try and stretch and distort reality based on images that he sees. And if you take his very own logic and try and twist it to suit an agenda, you can say that the elephant symbol that the Republicans use is directly correlated to, it's very similar to the elephants that Hannibal used when he tried to take over the world. So therefore, the Republicans must be like Hannibal in trying to take over the world.
No question.
It's insanity what he's doing.
Yeah, the elephant is representative. Of course, the giant elephants that were used by the orc army in Lord of the Rings. Like, you could make just as much an argument. Do you think, some people actually think that he doesn't mean it, that he makes this stuff up, and he's like, because he giggles in the middle. If you watch it, you see him. Occasionally, he'll say this stuff, and then he'll giggle weirdly after he said something, as if, "I just made this up, and I think it's funny that people are going to buy it."
You know, I originally thought that maybe this was a shtick,
right?
Kind of like a Hannity. It's all about ratings. It's all about getting viewers. It's all about making money. I've converted to the point where I think he truly believes the nonsense that's spewing out of his mouth, and that makes him extremely dangerous.
Absolutely. You know, not just to the public at large, but I think to the people around him. I mean, he's got kind of this odd messianic thing going on that's stunning. That is stunning. Thank you so much for the call, Tom. By the way, I'll be in Chicago the first week of October doing stand-up at the Improv, which I know is in Schaumburg. Don't give me that. I grew up in Chicago. I know. But because I'm from Chicago, I will be hanging out in Chicago every night. So, I'm one of those guys who will, like, leave the club immediately and drive straight downtown just because I love it. Chicago's an amazing city. And I think, personally, and this is my own personal thing, I think the Chicago city planners who revamped Millennium Park and fixed a lot of the problems that were going on downtown and helped gentrify the architecture around the south side of Chicago. It should be in charge of New Orleans, the rebuilding of New Orleans. I think they could find a way to build streets and roads and raise the land in areas where if water did come through there again, it wouldn't hurt so many people. There's a lot of smart guys working on that. I'm going to go to Scott, who... are you there, Scott? You're
yes,
in Cape Cod.
Good morning, sir. How are you?
I'm fantastic. And yourself?
Good. I'd like to discuss Obama's sinister plan to indoctrinate our children.
Yes, I saw that on Glenn Beck, that he was very concerned that there's going to be a big the Hitler Youth rally that
Obama's
planning.
Well, that's the wrong analogy, sir.
Okay.
Obama is a Marxist. He is a communist.
Sure. I can tell.
This communist manifesto of his, but he has... it's.
Yeah, I know he's like, next week he's planning on telling kids to stay in school and study. I know, it's sickening.
There's sinister characters that are behind this plot. You have Rahm Emanuel, the chief of staff of Fervent Zionist. You have David Axelrod.
Yeah, he is Jewish, I heard. I heard Rahm Emanuel is a Jew.
You have George Soros, who's an international banker.
Right, he's Greek or something, right? Which is, as they said on Strangers with Candy, Greeks are just Jews without money. So you got to worry about them.
Saul Alinsky is a communist radical.
Saul's crazy. I know. You can tell it's the ski on the end of his name. I think that's why Hitler actually invaded Poland, was because
the wrong analogy. These are all communist Jews, and the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion. Did you ever read the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion?
Of course. I have the book on tape. I got to be honest with you.
Protocol number 5 discusses the super government that we have, and the Jews are ruthlessly determined to destroy America.
Fascinating. Does the regular government actually have to go into a phone booth and turn into the super government, or does it always have its superpowers? I'm always confused. Yes, or just kind of anytime.
The Jews control our government.
You know what? And how do they control our government?
I'll tell you how they control our
government. No, you won't. sorry, that was a bait. And then you wonder, people go, I don't know where Glenn Beck gets all those viewers. I'm sorry, I had to drop the call. That was my mistake. I accidentally hit the button. No, I didn't, for comedy. Landon in Mississippi, we got about a minute left. Landon, you there?
Yeah, what's going on, man?
Are you concerned at all about the Jewish super government that is going to indoctrinate our kids into a communist socialist manifesto next week?
Are you serious?
No, of course not. That was the last caller. I'm kidding.
It's okay. But, isn't Glenn Beck, hasn't he been diagnosed bipolar before?
I believe so. I know he is what is commonly referred to as a dry drunk, because, he's a recovery. He calls himself an alcoholic, but insofar as I know, he's not in AA, as it were, so he doesn't get continuing program. But he certainly acts that way. He certainly at least has his manic depressive moments. I mean, the vacillation between the kind of giddy giggling that he does, and then the tears did not necessarily point to someone who has a healthy kind of hormone breakdown in their brain.
Yeah, he's definitely in a, if he is like type 1 bipolar, he's definitely in a full-blown manic state right now. He's just out there, man. He's so, I know.
It's fascinating. Thank you for the call, Landon. I appreciate it. It's funny to me that they're kind of, if you take someone in this situation, this is sort of the sad and scary part of this. If you take someone who's in that kind of a mental state, and then you just kind of, you support them in that behavior, they tend to kind of, either implode rather sadly or explode rather dangerously. And that's my concern about Glenn Beck, you know. We'll deal with that. After I come back from the break, we are lucky enough to have Assemblyman John Perez from the wonderful state of of California, who will be with us. And then at the top of the next hour, Jeff Charlotte, who wrote The Family, which is going to be a fascinating discussion. And back to your calls as well. We'll be right back. I'm Hal Sparks, filling in for Stephanie on the Stephanie Miller Show.
Well, that just seems intentionally confusing.
It's the Stephanie Miller Show.
Time out. I hate to break out of character, but you cannot shout into a person's ear. It does damage. If you know, the spinning I don't mind. I didn't.
It's the Stephanie Miller Show. I'm Hal Sparks, filling in for Steph and the Mooks while they're away on vacation. 1-800-STEPH-12 is our number. I actually want to go to Aja in Boston because you've been holding a long time. And Aja, you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Fantastic. You and I are both geeking out about wireless energy.
Yes, I have to say, I first heard the news from you, and when I did, I was so relieved because I had an argument with a friend not too long ago, mm-hmm. and he's very cynical. If it didn't come on the 6 o'clock news, as far as he's concerned, it didn't happen.
Right.
But I heard what you said, and I said, this is great, because he and I had a conversation about Tesla, and I said, well, you know, Tesla has, like 100 different patents or
right.
so in that have never, like, come to fruition. And, you know, it's like a lot of them have gone missing, and I was trying to tell him about how he had this idea of supplying, like, energy to the whole world using the ionosphere. And having this wireless electricity, and he's like, oh, that's a bunch of crap. And I'm like, no, I'm serious.
Right.
I heard you this morning. I was like, oh, this is great.
See, I told you.
Rub it in his face.
I try to, you know, my goal in life is to win bar bets for people without them ever starting. And this particular thing, you know, again, I said it's a game changer on so many fronts. The idea, you know. Because, you know, everybody's been talking about, okay, we can get solar power, we can get wind power, but how does that affect transportation? How can we translate that into it affecting one-on-one vehicles, not just trains, not just that kind of stuff? And if we can get a system in this country where you pass through even certain areas, where you don't even have to line all the streets with them, we get a minimal battery to, charging area drive through where you have them on these massive interstates where they just have like sections of road every 25 miles that charge you as you drive, and so they're not consistent, you're not on this thing the entire time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's hundreds of ways that wireless energy could shift forever.
That's true, and because it can be available to everybody in the world, like all the other countries can, like, we can all be kind of like on the same footing, or at least we have like the grounding.
Absolutely.
To start on the same footing.
And again, like I said, it's American technology.
Right.
You know, this is stuff that we have come up with, and through the patents and creation, you know, stuff we do in the United States, instead of having the car companies and the oil companies suppressing it,
exactly.
This actually becomes the edge of the new industry that we have in this country, which is fantastic.
Right on. That's something else that I wanted to say to kind of like bring this back.
I've got 10 seconds. I gotta go. I gotta go. But we'll talk again. I'm Hal Sparks, filling in for Steph on the Stephanie Miller Show. 1-800-STEPH-12. We'll be right back after this with Assemblyman John Perez.
When you're telling these little stories, here's a good idea. Have a point. It makes it so much more interesting for the listener.
It's the Stephanie Miller Show. I'm Hal Sparks, filling in for Stephanie while she's away on vacation. 1-800-STEPH-12 is our number. I'm at Hal Sparks on Twitter. You can also find me on Facebook and MySpace without many problems. On the line right now, I have California Assemblyman John Perez. John, are you there?
Yes, good to be with you.
Yeah, absolutely. Good to talk to you again. You and I met personally at the Hero Awards the other evening on behalf of the Stonewall Young Democrats organization. You're a smart and funny guy, and there's so much going on in California right now. And I think in a lot of ways, so, you know, as go with California, so go with the nation insofar as You know, we felt some of the financial difficulties harder than others. We have interesting back and forths on the rights of our citizenry that set the tone for the rest of the country as well. And I just wanted to address that, some of that, with you. How are your feelings on, we've been dealing with a little bit of a Prop 8 all this week, and everyone's waiting for some sort of legislative or judicial answer to this. How do you think it's going?
Well, I mean, obviously there can't be a legislative solution because the voters, the voters trumped our ability to do anything legislatively in any meaningful way, so we're waiting for a judicial decision.
Right.
I'm actually, the last Supreme Court ruling, I think, gave us a glimmer of hope when it protected the 18,000 marriages that happened last year. Because that does two things. One, it says that the court really wanted to be with us, but they couldn't directly overturn the voters. Two, it sets up a very different challenge in the future because now it's not gay people challenging why they're being treated differently than straight folks, but you also create a situation whereby there are two classes now of gay couples.
Right.
There are gay couples that got married during that window, and then there's everybody else. So now when you go and challenge, you can say, why should I, as a gay man in a relationship with another gay man, not have the same rights as this other gay couple? That is a very different legal challenge than anything that's ever been tested before. You couple that with the efforts to get the U.S. Supreme Court to rule on this, and I think that there's some real hope on the horizon.
I agree. I think it's very strange in this, in America, that where we believe in ourselves as the bastion of freedom, as the we refer to our president normal people, not like Glenn Beck, refers to him as a Marxist, but the rest of us refer to our president in general as the leader of the free world. That's a common vernacular. And yet it's strange to me that you can go to Illinois and stand on the border of Iowa as a gay couple. And if you're on the Illinois side of that border, you can't get married. But 6 feet away on the other side of that line, you can. And that seems very strange. And I think will ultimately be the end of these kind of laws. Because it's such a peculiar, drawing this line. And I think that speaks to, the couples that got married and can keep their marriages and the ones that didn't and aren't allowed to.
Yeah, no, it absolutely is. And this is one of those weird areas for especially politicians on the national stage where they're afraid to say what they really believe. They're afraid that that the voters won't back them up. And in California, it's really shocking because I serve with a bunch of people in the legislature who want to be with us on gay marriage but are afraid to. And I'm not talking about Democrats. The Democratic members are fine.
Right.
But every time this issue comes up and we have a discussion on the floor of the legislature, if the cameras could just watch all the members coming to my desk after the debate was over and having my Republican colleagues come and apologize to me for the fact that they can't vote the way they want to. So it becomes a very, very odd issue.
Yeah.
And it's a throwback to where we were prior to the Supreme Court ruling that said that interracial marriage could not be barred by the states.
Right.
This notion that one state treats people differently than anywhere else. And in that case, California was 20 years ahead ahead of the federal government.
Right. And I think in some ways, still was. I think Prop 8 and the passage of it was kind of a political anomaly that it largely passed because there was a section of the populace that thought it could never pass here and didn't really didn't act on the real threat that was there. And then we're caught off guard when it actually got through. And then, I think the opposite of what happened in Iowa, which is that'll, legalizing gay marriage will never pass here. And then, oops, it did.
That's definitely true. Hey, but the other thing is, if you look at the population in general versus voters, you get two very different numbers.
Mm-hmm.
We made tremendous progress from 2000 in Prop 22 to 2008 in Prop 8.
Mm-hmm.
If this goes back on the ballot, let's say in 2012, I think we'd win. My hope is that before we get to that point, the courts will actually rule and make it unnecessary for us to have to go get political support to establish rights that people should clearly have under our Constitution.
Right, right. Well, yeah, just I think it becomes, and the generations as they change, it makes it a lot easier to make this point as well. I think, you know, if you look at the younger generations coming up, they do not have as hard a line about this as the older generation does. And these shifts are not quick because, you know, it really is about a turnover in attitude from younger to older. Yeah,
it is, and it's also because people package so much else in the term.
Right.
Maybe it's because my parents were married twice. They first got married civilly, and then about 6 months later they got married in the church. Mm-hmm. But I always understood the distinction between a civil marriage and a religious marriage.
Sure.
Maybe other people have a harder time unpackaging those two. But it always is a generational shift.
Yeah, and I also think that should be a very stark, obvious thing in the moment the minister, the priest, the rabbi or whomever is conducting your ceremony says, by the power invested in me by the state of California, they are man and wife. It seems like that's in every single ceremony and should be very obvious to people that the state civilly joins people, no matter who they are. Marriage is something that happens in a church, and there are churches who are okay with gay people being married, and there are churches that are not. But the state has an interest in the freedom of its citizens to allow them to join civilly no matter what. So holding that back seems very strange, and I think the using marriage as a buzzword has been the thing that's given some success.
Couldn't agree with you more.
Yeah. So I greatly appreciate you being on the air with us this morning. Assemblyman John Perez, Los Angeles 46th District, and doing a fantastic job. And hopefully we'll talk to you again in the future after the fires are all put out.
I would love to do that. Thanks a lot, Hal.
Appreciate it. Cheers. Thank you very much. You know, he's I had the joy of talking to him the other night at the Hero Awards, and a really bright guy and really honest and direct, you know. John Perez, of course, California's, I think, first openly gay assemblyman elected in California, which also seems like impossible that it would take as long as it did. I got a time to take one caller before we go to the break, but Buddy in Columbus, Ohio, you wanted to call about health care.
Yes, it looks like the president's going to back down on the public option. It's time for people to call the White House, 202-456-1111. Now, last November, I got up at 4 in the morning, and I ended my day at 10 at night as a legal representative for Barack Obama in a poll to make sure everybody's got the right to vote and their vote is counted. Now, what they want to do is they want to put in this thing called triggers. In the healthcare system, which is just another way of saying money for the insurance companies. So at some nebulous time down the road, if the health insurance companies don't do what we need them to do, then the public option will trigger.
Right.
What a load of crap.
I know. Which should have
happened down the road.
Right. It would have happened already if they were going to do it.
Well, also down the road when the quote-unquote trigger fires, that the same people will spend billions and billions of dollars to stop it then.
Right. To stop the trigger. Absolutely.
It's time to call the White House and say public option or nothing.
I think it's I appreciate the call. Absolutely. I think it's always time to call your representative and the White House and tell them what you want. That never stops happening. On the upside, at the on the politics page of the HuffPost, Axelrod and Obama are making a very distinct point that they are still in favor of a public option, and the president says he's willing to do almost anything to make that deal happen, which is a good sign. I still think they're having a hard time wrestling this thing out of committee, away from the people who want control of it. And that's the hard part, is if there are guys in committee who will keep it in committee as long as there's a public option, you have to give them a signal that you're okay with it not being in there, just so you can get it out of there, and then you can take the one that's in the House bill and put it back in. I think that's a big part of what's going on. After we come back from the break, we got more Glenn Beck silliness, which is really fun, and Pat Buchanan going well beyond silliness to clear insanity. And some would say, and I'm comfortable saying it, racism. I'm Hal Sparks. I'm filling in for Stephanie and the Mooks while they're away on vacation. 1-800-STEP-12 is our number. We'll be right back after this.
What the hell was that?
It's the Stephanie Miller Show.
be like a crazy person.
I'm quite sure they will say so.
Ding, ding, ding.
What do we have for her, Johnny?
This is Hal Sparks filling in on the Stephanie Miller Show. 1-800-STEP-12 is our number. We're talking about all things healthcare, all things equal rights, and all things kooky with Glenn Beck. I want to play that that clown clip again of Glenn Beck. This is him complaining that by night after night going on and saying bat crap crazy stuff, that all of a sudden he has to live in a gated community, and he doesn't want that.
Do you think I want to get on the air every night and tell you this stuff?
Yes.
Do you know who I am?
No.
The media will they'll say, oh, he's just a clown. Well, you know what? I am a clown.
Well, I'm glad we're in agreement then. That's fantastic. And play the rest of it, Tony.
I am a guy who just... I just want to have laughs and fun. I'm a capitalist. I want to make money. I want to do all that stuff.
All that stuff.
I want to live my life with my family.
I want to live.
I don't want to have to live with security and walls and gates and everything else. Do you think I want to live that way?
I'm in love, and I don't care who knows it.
There's just a level on which you can't blame. Again, there's this big thing about personal responsibility on the right, where they claim that, you know, they're the crowd of personal responsibility, and on Randy and selfishness, you know, the focus on, you know, I take care of myself and nobody else has to worry about me. And then to go on and whine every night about, you know, you're like, if people are going to give Eminem crap for complaining that he can't eat at Burger King without being bothered, why does Glenn Beck get to complain that, like, all I'm doing is fomenting violence and craziness, and then I have to live I have to put bars on my windows because some dude from Oklahoma wants to crawl into bed with me with an AK-47 and hug me and whisper things about commies in my ear while I don't want that. I want to just put the gun on the nightstand. That's all I'm asking. It's wonderfully crazy. Now, on the other side of the spectrum, you have, the less fun version of crazy is Pat Buchanan, who America's cutest racist, clearly, because with his funny comb over and his Winnie Pooh voice, kind of voice, he's allowed to go on TV and say the most vile crap, because he can shape it in a way that it seems cute, he gets away with it. He just did, wrote an article, a column, arguing that Adolf Hitler didn't want to launch the European War. That it was, he didn't really want to do it, he kind of had to. You know, all he wanted was Danzig back. All he wanted was the Polish city of Gdansk back. And if darn old Poland had just given him Gdansk back, he would have just, because it was a big German city, which wasn't. But and he argues, okay, this is what he says. The German-Polish War had come out of a quarrel over the town the size of Ocean City, Maryland. In summer, Danzig, 95% German, had recently been severed from Germany at Versailles in violation of Woodrow Wilson's principle of self-determination. Even British leaders thought Danzig should be returned. Why did Warsaw not negotiate with Berlin, which was hinting at an offer of compensatory territory in Slovakia? Because the Poles had a war guarantee from Britain that should Germany attack, Britain and her empire would come to Poland's rescue. Was Danzig worth a war? Unlike the 7 million Hong Kongese whom the British surrendered to Beijing, who didn't want to go, the Danzigers were clamoring to return to Germany. In the article on Raw Stories, his note, the city of Danzig, now known as Gdansk, is not a town the size of Ocean City, Maryland. It's one of the biggest cities in Poland, and historically played a major role in the trade in the Baltic and North Seas. Nobody wants a useless city, no matter how many of their citizens are in it. There's, if it's on a nice waterway, if it's got mineral rights, that kind of, this is the kind of things you roll tanks in for. So, fascinating that this is, Buchanan followed his assertion that Poland could have prevented the war with an argument that Hitler was not interested in a broader war to conquer the world. He wasn't interested in that at all. No, But if Hitler was out to conquer the world, says Pat Buchanan,
Why did he spend 3 years building that hugely expensive Siegfried line to protect Germany from France? Why did he start the war with no surface fleet, no troop support and transports, and only 29 ocean-going submarines? How do you conquer the world with a navy that can't get out of the Baltic Sea? Why did he offer the British peace twice after Poland fell and again after France fell? Maybe just because he was insane, a crappy leader, a bad war planner, or perhaps because he wasn't ready to go to full war yet and he was building it piece by piece. Maybe you build a wall between you and France because you know that they'll object to the kind of crap you're about to do to the 6 million Jews, the million or so gypsies, the mentally ill, the physically incapacitated, the people that he euthanized because they weren't perfect. Maybe because he knew what he was up to. But anyways, it's already got me into where I'm arguing logic with this or whatever. And the answer, by the way, that Buchanan has is Hitler wanted to end the war in 1940, almost 2 years before the trains began to roll to the camps. Yeah. So he just wanted to be left to kill Jews in peace. That's ultimately Buchanan's argument here. It's insanity. And I don't know why he continues to be, you know, it's like he and Lou Dobbs say stuff that's on par with anything that Glenn Beck comes up with. And because Glenn Beck weeps and wails and gnashes his teeth, we're clearly, we know he's nuts, and so we kind of dismiss it. But at the same time, you know, if Pat Buchanan, you know, says it, it's just because he was in the Nixon administration, it's fine. I don't get that at all. And because Lou Dobbs says it because he's kind of chubby and white and he's on CNN, that's okay, too. This part is insane. I want to take a couple of calls. By the way, at the top of the next hour, we have Jeff Charlotte, who wrote the book on the family. And the family, for those of you who don't know, is a dominionist organization that works secretly in the United States government. And I don't want to sound paranoid about this. They actually do. It's not one of those things like, you know, the Pentavlet or the Illuminati kind of situations. They actively will say that. They'll come out and go, yeah, that's what we do. We just don't talk about it. And there are a lot of, they run this prayer breakfast every year to put kind of a smiley face on it. They attract Christian zealots to their organization and put a lot of them to work, quite frankly. And then they pick candidates and they help further those kind of choices, you know, by shuffling money around. And because they're a church, they have no taxes to pay and they can do whatever they want with their land and they can acquire land and those kind of things. And they use that very effectively. And they don't, the odd part about them, the craziest part, is that they don't seem to care who they're in business with. They seem to be comfortable with dictators and warlords and terrorists if they think it will further their aims, because they believe that this is what Jesus ultimately would have wanted, that anything can ultimately serve the teachings of Christ. Even child rape, which is, a fantastically insane thought. They're comfortable, very comfortable with this idea. I'll take one call before I go, because I wanted Anna in Spokane, Washington, because of we were talking in the last block about gay marriage. Anna, are you there?
Yes, I am, Hal. Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
I have some relatives that are cousins, and mm-hmm. they wanted to get married. So you can't legally get married in our state. But they went to Canada,
right.
And they got married there. And they have all their benefits. They're legally recognized, the whole thing. And there's about seven states within – California is one of them – that you can legally get married also.
Right.
So why can they go up to Canada or go to California and get married and have it be recognized in Washington, but – the gays who get married in Iowa is not recognized
right.
in Washington.
Right,
so.
Because it's they were married on foreign soil. We have to honor the rights of other countries before that we honor the rights of our other states. It's very strange.
But even if they got married in California, it would still have been recognized here. It was closer to go to Canada than to go to California from here.
Very strange. It's odd. You know, again, those kind of limitations on personal freedom are very strange, and it's very odd that I know the right isn't fans of, you know, social freedom. I'm going to take a break.
Thanks, Al.
Thank you for the call. You know, it's odd that they'll fight for social freedom like crazy. You know, this idea that get the government out of my home. I just get your government hands off my Medicare. But if so that you could put them on the gay couple next to me and separate them. That's what to put the government hands somewhere else. I'm Hal Sparks. I'm filling in for Steph. 1-800-STEPH-12 is our number. We'll be back with Jeff Charlotte at the top of the next hour. Stay tuned. Thank you.
and gentlemen, it's the Stephanie Miller Show.
Drop your shorts and bend over, Mr. Babar.
Well, now, I'm no lawyer, but I do believe that's a violation of my rights.
It's the Stephanie Miller Show. I'm Hal Sparks, filling in for Steph and the Mooks while they're away on vacations. 1-800-STEPH-12 is our number. In a moment, we're going to have Jeff Charlotte on to talk about his book, The Family. For those of you that are Maddow fans, she has had him on a couple of times to talk about this organization. And they are fascinating. If you get a chance to pick up the book, I highly recommend it. It's pretty stunning. We're getting him on the line in just a moment. But I want to go with, John in, Ferndale. Hold on. Wait, we may have him, and then I'll go back to John in a second. Yes, here he is. Okay, we've got him. Jeff, are you there? Do I have him? Have I got him? I don't know if I have him. Very exciting. We'll see. He's X'd out. She's getting him on the line. Jeff's book, we'll figure it out. It's okay to have technical difficulties. I'm new here. That's the best part of it. Let's see. We got him. There he is. Jeff, you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Fantastic. Hi, Jeff. It's great to talk to you.
Good to talk to you, Hal.
Yeah, I have to say, I'm a big fan of the book. I find it, it's jaw dropping. Some of the stuff that's in there. And you spent, you didn't intend to necessarily write this book, correct?
No, I really didn't.
And, yeah.
I would have been happy if I hadn't had to, but I stumbled on the story, and there it was.
Yeah, and what a story it was. I mean, it's immensely personal the way you tell the story, too, because I grew up, for those, like, some of the listeners may or may not know whatever, I grew up in a very small town, and we had a little Christian church, and we had guys who would roll through who would, you know, sell audio cassette tape systems on how evolution is crap, and you could buy it, and like really hardcore stuff. But the ones that would graduate from my church, the kind of people who were just really bought it hook, line, and sinker, and would go on to like Regent University or something like that, and then would be the top of their class at Regent University, which is a big Christian college, the Pat Robertson School, and even those guys might not even be ready for the family. They're a special group.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's what I really think that progressives need to wrestle with this fact. A lot of progressives and secular folks and even some conservatives tend to think of the Christian right as this one big monolith, and really right. It's there's a populist movement, and that's the Pat Robertson gang, and then there's
right.
This elite strand, which is, you know, best represented by the family, which is inside Washington. They, you know, the Pat Robertson crowd, they're sort of banging on the doors from the outside. They want to get in. They, you know, they're ultimately
right.
Denouncing government and trying to get in. The family is on the inside. That's where they began.
Well, and also the family looks down on them, do they not?
You know, they do. I mean, the family looks at someone like the late Jerry Falwell, and, you know, this big, heavyset Southern guy pounding his pulpit and thumping his Bible and going on and on about homosexuality, and they think he's tacky. I mean, there's a real class issue going on here because the family is upper class. It's the oldest, most influential religious right organization in America, and they really go back to the 1930s, not to the masses, but to the idea that they had to create a movement that was apart from the masses,
mm-hmm.
beyond the din of the vox populi, as the founder put it, which is beyond the voice of the people, that we are entering what he called the age of minority control. And by that, he did not mean diversity, but a few key chosen elites who would be anointed by God for leadership.
Which sounds suspiciously like how the monarchies were run.
Well, they were great admirers of
yeah.
the monarchies. The founder of the group, a guy named Abraham Verady, was a Norwegian immigrant. He came to America when he was a young man. He saw it as the land of the Bible Unchained, as he put it. And, you know, I think one of the sort of the proudest moments in his life is that when he rose to such influence in the United States and he went home to Norway, the king was there waiting to greet him. And he really became a sort of a friend of monarchs throughout
mm-hmm.
Europe. Queen Wilhelmina of the Netherlands was a major financial backer of the early family. The King of Greece was a great friend of theirs. And And they would also, this led them into sort of strange relationships. You might not expect, like Emperor Selassie of Ethiopia,
right.
You know, who reggae fans, you know, think of as this great figure. Emperor Selassie was actually a vicious dictator, but the family saw him as a key man for Africa, and he in turn saw them as access to American power, gave a lot of money to the family, and Ethiopia ended up becoming one of the largest beneficiaries of Cold War armaments from the United States.
Right, and there's this constant tie between them and the military-industrial complex, too. They really do... I forget, was it Raytheon that one of their,
Raytheon Corporation, a guy named Tom Phillips.
Right, Tom Phillips.
Very involved in the group, and he helped finance their purchase of their current headquarters. A lot of people in the news have been hearing about this house on Capitol Hill called C Street.
Sure, I went there.
Townhouse.
Yeah, when I went and performed in Arlington, I went there and twittered a picture standing in front of the place or whatever. It's becoming a little tourist destination for.
Excellent. Well, they can, you know, they can make a little extra money selling
tours.
The real headquarters, though, is this mansion out in Arlington called the Cedars. It's a $7 million mansion, beautiful, beautiful place overlooking the Potomac River, the end of a dead end. End of a cul-de-sac.
Mm-hmm.
They own about 20 properties in the neighborhood. It's like a suburban compound in a way. And this they purchased with money that came from, among others, the CEO of Raytheon, Tom Phillips. Money also came from various oil executives, other defense contractors, all these guys who, you know, and I'll give them the benefit of the doubt. I'll say they're sincere in their beliefs. Their beliefs are that God wants them to be rich and wants to work through them and wants to give them power. The family, you know, at the heart of their message really, truly is. This is not me sort of maligning them. This is what they say.
Right.
Jesus' message was not meant for the masses. It was meant only for a few. And the rest of us need to be kept quiet whatever kind of pabulum they want to dispense to us.
Right.
They'll take care of us. You know, they'll take care of us. They know what's best for us. It's sort of trickle-down fundamentalism.
Right, exactly. And then and that works within the organization of the family as well, because you have kind of the elites of the organization that live very well, and then almost kind of like a mild slave labor force, as it were, like the really indoctrinated worker bees who, you know, which you joined, you know, up with while you were writing the book. Correct. You know, Rake and Leaves. Yeah.
The beginning of the book, I tell the story of living for a month in one of the houses in the orbit of the great, big, beautiful mansion called Cedars.
Right.
This house was called Ivan Wallace. For the younger guys, 20s, I was sort of pushing it.
Right.
I was, I think, 29 or 30, then I can't
right.
remember. Guys who are sort of usually from affluent families or some kind of better background, and go there, and they do really kind of grunt work. At the same time, they get assigned a mentor who is a congressman or perhaps an ambassador, a businessman. There's regular, very prominent speakers come in two or three nights a week. And the whole idea is that while you're there being sort of a worker bee, you're being groomed for
right.
future leadership in the family. And you graduate from there. A lot of the guys will be sent, because the family is very international. They're not like the sort of domestic-oriented Christian right. You might, one of the guys I was there with was sent off to the Ivory Coast
mm-hmm.
in Africa to be sort of a missionary to the government of that country. Remember, these are not missionaries to regular folks. These, in other words, are becoming really almost sort of a shadow government. They go and they say to, you know, the leaders of a small country like Ivory Coast, you
right.
know, we can make connections for you with U.S. senators and so on.
Right,
so
brokering
they're
deals.
Functioning like, yeah, exactly.
Like lobbyists deals. Almost.
Sorry, like what?
Like lobbyists, almost, you know.
Like lobbyists,
yeah.
They're walking and talking like lobbyists, and I think this is one of the big issues. And one of the things, I wrote this book over the last several years, but one of the issues the C Street scandals this summer brought out is working with an outfit called the Military Religious Freedom Foundation. We tracked the travel records, first of Senator Ensign, who,
mm-hmm.
of course, was conducting an affair while he was at the family C Street house, and then Senator Coburn, who was also living in the C Street house and helping him cover up the affair,
right.
and then we were able to track back from there. And we saw that the family was paying for travel for both these guys and others all over the world, these politicians using their status as representing the United States, but going on the family's dime to foreign governments, and instead of representing U.S. interests, representing what one of them, Senator James Inhofe, said is the political philosophy of Jesus as taught to him by the family. The political philosophy of Jesus, that's his word. So really, you know, the family tried to defend itself by saying this is just a personal thing, just a personal prayer
right.
group. Well, it's not when you're going to, say, as Senator Coburn has done to the government of Lebanon, countries torn by war between Muslims and Christians for decades, key country for the United States in terms of national security, for our relationship with Islam. And what does Senator Coburn do? He goes there on the family's dime, says, I'm a representative of the United States Senate, and I'm here to set up Christian prayer cells in your government.
Wow. Yeah.
You know, that's a threat to our national security.
It absolutely
is. It looks an awful lot like lobbying. You know, I mean, that's something for the lawyers to decide. But I think the question at least needs to be raised.
Well, you know, it's interesting that they just kind of bypass if they can't get clearance for what they want to accomplish on a geopolitical level from the actual government, but it's in line with their beliefs in the family, then the family will pay for it. We'll pay for them to go.
Exactly. Although that kind of travel, I mean, you know, to put that kind of travel in perspective, much of that travel would be illegal now under the 2007 Open Government Act, which was passed in response to the Jack Abramoff scandals.
Right.
So if listeners out there saying, isn't this just what people do? It is what Jack Abramoff used to do,
mm-hmm.
And it's now illegal.
Right.
Unfortunately, what the family has done is instead of now these guys are traveling not on the family's dime, but on your dime. Senator Inhofe, for instance, has been going and promoting the political philosophy of Jesus, Middle East, Africa, Eastern Europe, and he does so on the tab of the U.S. Senate Armed Services Committee. He even boasts in one video. He says his daughter was getting ready for a missionary trip to Africa, and he says, hey, honey, why don't you go with me, and then we can charge it to the government.
Wow.
I mean, it's really kind of astonishing. And when we looked into this, we saw several other congressmen doing the same thing, including using military transport planes to pursue their missionary agendas around the world. So, you know, here we have a time when our military is stretched thin, to say the least.
Right.
And these guys think a priority is to have a whole big giant plane flying them around Africa so they can expound on the political philosophy of Jesus. And for Christians out there, when they're talking about the political philosophy of Jesus, it's not anything you've ever heard in your church.
Right.
The family says, this is really key. The family looks at it and they say, Doug Coe, the leader, he likes to say, who are the three men in the 20th century who best understood the New Testament? Most people are going to say Martin Luther King, maybe the more conservative. They say Billy Graham. Responds, no, it's Hitler, Stalin, and Mao. He says they're evil men, but they understood that the New Testament is about power. It's about power and strength. That's what these guys see, and when they go and pursue foreign affairs, that's what they look for. They look for
right.
local strong.
That's the prism with which they view the world. That's the
exactly.
prism through which they view it. Yeah, it's an amazing book, and from the the sort of large geopolitical to the very personal, I think the story that you tell about the guy making the argument that he's not racist by dancing around singing Al Green, and pulling his shirt up and his pants down, to show it's very like.
We better explain that one.
Yeah, the undercurrent, yeah.
Well, this is one of the House leaders of Ivanwald, the house I lived in, guy named Jeff Connolly.
Yeah.
And this all followed a sort of, in fact, I don't think I put this in the book,
mm-hmm.
It followed an evening session with Cal Thomas, the popular right-wing syndicated columnist, who told us that the only reason we don't have slavery is because of Christianity. He said that Christianity gives you the only reason not to keep black people as slaves. And he said secular people are not opposed to slavery. Only Christians are opposed to slavery.
Wow.
And that's the only reason not. And so it was sort of astonishing. We were talking about this, and a lot of the guys really thought this was pretty profound. Now, I happen to be from upstate New York, and and my brother, as he was called, Jeff Conley, who's one of the leaders of the House, he was from North Carolina, and he had a bit of a chip on his shoulder, and he felt that all Yankees thought that all Southerners were racist, and he wanted to show me that this wasn't true by expressing his great appreciation for Al Green,
right,
and doing an eerie impersonation of Al Green.
And arguing that he's that he's really black. He's
really black, and it got into some kind of ugly stuff. He started talking about his Alabama black snake, and you really get the sense of what this is. This is a fundamentalist frat house. I mean, and that's the whole. You know, there's a sort of absurdist level in which these guys, the same thing at the C Street house, by the way, where Senator Ensign is living.
Right.
You know, I mean, a lot of sort of ribald jokes in the same context of, you know, one minute they're telling sort of dirty jokes, another minute they're saying, now let's pray for the downfall of the demonic stronghold of Buddhism.
Right,
you know,
exactly.
Some extreme to extreme.
And then, cheating on their wives and basically sacking out at C Street house while it's all happening.
Exactly.
Ensign
and Congressman Kittering of Mississippi, right, brought his mistress to the C Street house, and now there's divorce proceedings going on around that, and Congressman Kittering and the national GOP are doing everything they can to keep his personal diary private because, according to allegations made by his wife, it's going to reveal, not only we know that he took his mistress, who, by the way, wasn't just a mistress, she was the heiress and executive of a major corporation, Cellular South, to which, as congressman, he directed millions and federal dollars.
Right.
And then he left Congress in 2008 to become a lobbyist for his own mistress's company.
Wow.
So it's all pretty, pretty seedy. And I think in this diary he's kept, if this comes out, we're waiting to see what happens with the court there in Mississippi. We're going to see what other congressmen knew about this and help cover this up.
It's a fascinating book, and I have a feeling you're going to have to write an update to it fairly soon. There will be, you know,
in the works. Look for it next summer.
Yeah, just fascinating and great writing too. It's very gripping. I'm up against a hard break. And I got to go. But Jeff Charlotte, thank you so much. It's a fantastic book. The Family is out now, and then the update will be out next summer. So fantastic. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Hal.
Yeah, appreciate it. We'll be back right after this. I'm Hal Sparks. I'm filling in for Stephanie Miller on while she and the gang are away on vacation. 1-800-STEP-12. We'll be taking your calls after this. And then we've got a special guest in the bottom half of the hour who is a regular on the show. And won an award earlier in the week, if you didn't hear. Very exciting. Jim Ward will be with us calling in from Planet Vacation at 8:30. Very exciting. We'll be back right after this. I'm Hal Sparks filling in on The Stephanie Miller Show.
Who are those freaks?
It's The Stephanie Miller Show.
The hell's the matter with you?
It's the Stephanie Miller Show. I'm Hal Sparks, filling in for Steph and Jim and Chris while they're out on vacation, and it's wonderful. I'm having a great time, and I hope they are too. I hope they're relaxing. I know Chris sometimes listens to the show, and I keep trying to get him not to. Not because I'm afraid, but because I think he needs to actually take a break. It's just helpful, I don't take a vacation, but I hear it helps other people. Anyways, we haven't got much time. After I come back from this break, I went so long in the Jeff Charlotte interview. I know this is such a short segment. But after we get back, we're going to talk to Jim Ward. Jim's going to be here, and we're going to congratulate him on air. And not only that, but Rebecca Baker on Phones and Drums will be interviewing our own Jim Ward. It's Hal Sparks, and this is The Stephanie Miller Show. It's the Stephanie Miller Show. I'm Hal Sparks, filling in for Steph and Jim and Chris while they're away on vacation. And by away on vacation, I mean one of them is actually going to be with us in just a second. 1-800-STEPH-12 is our number. We'll be returning to all things Idiot Glenn Beck in just a moment. But I'm very excited on the line. Wait. Before we do that, I want to actually turn the show over to Rebecca Baker, associate producer Rebecca Baker, on drums, as she's often referred to. Are you there? You
good? Yes, I'm here.
Oh,
it's Rebecca.
Yay!
For you guys out there, you may know me as the Stephanie Miller call screener who hangs up on you. You may also know me as the guest booker, travel planner, general scapegoat of
it's
the
true.
Stephanie Miller Show.
If there's a problem, you're usually to blame, even
I'm
if you're not.
I'm here to solve it.
Yes.
Right, exactly, or the cause of all the problems.
Mm-hmm.
Or you may also know me as the leading female Ross Perot impersonator in the United States.
Wow.
So I'll give you a little
okay,
bit right
please
now.
Do, yes.
Na-na-na, can I finish? I got a pie chart.
That's good, sure,
thanks.
Sure,
thanks.
Absolutely.
Okay.
It's a little 90s, but it's good.
Right, right.
Yeah.
It's a little dated. But more importantly, we have someone amazing on the line, someone we have all come to know and love, Mr. Jim Ward of the Stephanie Miller Show. Jim!
Wow, I get a fanfare.
Oh,
cool.
Yeah, you deserve it. How are you?
How are you doing? Can you hear me?
Are you awake?
First time caller.
Congratulations on your Emmy win.
Thanks.
So I have a few questions for you.
Okay.
When you found out you won, were you wearing any pants?
Yes.
Okay.
I was wearing a suit, in fact.
You were wearing a suit. Did you potty your pants?
No.
Okay, very good. So you weren't wearing a summer dress or anything like that?
No.
Very well. Did you go to a party?
Well, they had all the food and drinks and stuff afterwards, and I'd sit around with my Emmy, letting everyone see the Emmy.
Uh-huh, absolutely.
So that was fun.
And where is your Emmy now?
It is on the mantle by the flat-screen TV.
Nice.
Still don't have the name engraved on there, and that I gotta order that.
Oh, you have to order that. Are they making you pay for that?
Probably.
Yeah, exactly.
Is it like a high school picture or whatever? Like they give you an Emmy and you can have like three inches and 5-6 inches and one main one and, you know, like wallet size?
No, I think it's pretty much one size fits all kind of thing. But they did, we did have to pay to go to this thing this year, you know, because of the recession and all.
Oh my gosh.
But it was worth it.
What was your reaction when you won? I mean, were you just beside yourself?
I just, well, first of all, you know, one of my competitors was Jim Cummings, who's another animation guy I've worked with for years. And so he said earlier, I just hope somebody named Jim wins. So when I heard Jim, I was expecting to hear Cummings, but no. I just jumped up and said, no way. And
wow, that's very cool that you guys are supportive of each other.
I hugged Bart Simpson, Nancy Cartwright, who I actually knew in college, was doing the announcements.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Did she make you join Scientology immediately afterwards?
She tried.
Yeah.
She tried doing that voodoo mind meld thing that they do, but it didn't take.
That's funny. And did Janalicious give you any sort of congratulatory nookie after you won?
Of course.
Very good. That's what counts the most. And then I have one final question for you.
Yes.
Is now the show going to be called The Jim Ward Show?
Because
you won the Emmy?
I think it's going to be Hal Sparks' show.
With the award-winning Jim, with the Emmy award-winning Jim Ward, produced, directed, and created by. Yes.
Yeah, I'll just do the show from home on my cell phone.
Right. Exactly.
Well, you're a big shot now, so.
Yeah. Congratulations again.
Thanks. You know, Alex. Alex Trebek was the host of the thing, and I was amazed that no one used the joke. Well, I did it as Sean Connery because of that whole, you know, Saturday Night Live sketches.
Right.
Considering who the host is, I suppose I should phrase this in the form of a question. Who the hell is Jim Ward and why should I care?
Very good. Now, if people want to see an excerpt of your performance, where can they see that? Is that on your website?
You should go to jim-ward.com, which is the MySpace page, I'm told. Mm-hmm. I don't know about this computer stuff the kids are doing these days.
Luddite.
Facebook page thing. But you'll see a clip from Black and Mice from Mars, the one that made me win.
Yeah.
Just me doing a few different voices, you know, stuff I do in my sleep.
Right, exactly.
And then there's some other excerpts and some other things I've done.
And, of course, you can check out the Jim Wartile ad on stephaniemiller.com with the apocryphal but true, the CD. Yes. We can do sales even when you're not here.
Yeah,
we can take care
exactly.
of that business.
Well, thanks for joining us, Jim, and enjoy the rest of your vacation.
Thanks. I'm going back to sleep.
Absolutely.
Okay, I'll see you next week.
Well done. Yay! Jim Ward. Cheers.
Bye.
Such a good man. And Rebecca, fantastic work.
Oh, man, I'm so nervous. All right, back to you, Hal.
Shut up and never say anything again as long as you live.
You did a great job. I just want to say that you did...
Boy. What in the hell's the matter with you?
You were terrific. That was, it was so cute too, Rebecca, because you had your little answers printed out. She had questions for Jim, and she'd type them all up. Like, it was class. It was fantastic. You did so well. Well, back to the show. And again, a big round of applause for Jim Ward, because he deserved that Emmy 100 times over before he even got one. And now it'll be a tidal wave. Now he's got one. Now he's in the lexicon. So, you know, he'll get a daytime Emmy every couple of years. And it'll be, at a point, he'll be able to bowl with them. You know, he'll set up like nine pins Emmy statues in the corner. So I want to go, I want to get back to the, Glenn Beck, Buchanan, crazy off, because I think there is an argument to be made that one, you know, who is crazier? One is fun crazy, the Glenn Beck fun crazy, and one is like dangerous psycho crazy, which is Buchanan. Or is it the other way around? Is Buchanan fun because he sounds like Winnie the Pooh, but he's actually a racist psychopath? Or is Glenn Beck more fun because he's gonna lose it, on the air? On the line we have Andrea from, or is it Andrea from Miami, Florida? Is
that
Andrea, hello.
Hi. I just wanted to mention I saw Network this weekend, and, mm-hmm. you know, if either one of these guys had a brain the size of an inchworm, mm-hmm. I'd say, you know, they're doing a Howard Beale thing. But that's what they are doing, you know, and that's where their ratings are coming from. So we can only hope that it's going to end the same way that Network ended.
Right.
And we'll all be very happy.
Right. Well, Howard Beale, you know, was great in a film and as a character in a localized situation. But when you,
he became natural. I mean,
yeah,
you know,
but. The idea, you know, the idea of watching that and the idea of someone, you know, who's just, you know, losing it is great in a moment when you're watching that. But as a series, it gets kind of tired. And as you watch Glenn Beck, it becomes silly after a while.
I don't watch him. I just see these ridiculous things and I hear you guys talking about it. But, I mean, if he was smart enough to say, okay, this guy made it for a certain amount of time, but, you know, I mean, I don't even think he knows Network exists.
No.
But these people, I mean, maybe they have brain tumors and they're just going off the deep end and the show is just making the most of it.
Well, that's the thing you worry about. And I thank you for the call, is that, you know, that there's something, mentally wrong with him, and they're just kind of making money off of it. Not that I'm in the business of feeling sorry for Glenn Beck. I mean, he's clearly making his own bed and lying in it. But there is something to be said for people who are kind of mentally off the deep end, and people are standing behind them kind of rock star style going, no, keep doing that, dude, keep doing that, it's hilarious. And then they end up melting down and everybody else gets to go on. I've got about a minute left, and I want to go to Rob in Minneapolis. Rob, are you there?
Yeah.
You wanted to talk about Buchanan. I think this is the big smackdown on the right, who's nuttier and more weird. But go ahead, Buchanan, yes.
Speaking of Buchanan, mm-hmm. Hitler, I mean, Buchanan, it figures that one racist wouldn't acknowledge the racist thinking of another person because Hitler didn't want to invade England because he saw them as sort of white Europeans like himself,
right.
Not like him, but like the Germans. And even up to the middle of 1940, he thought that he could either work with them or at least get them to not oppose him.
Right. Well, that's the thing, is that I think until such time as he went, oh, they're not going to side with me against the dirty people I see all around me. Like, the paranoid is a big fan of everybody else on the bus until he realizes they don't believe him, you know.
Right. Right, exactly. It was like, you know, they created this fake thing called Aryanism to, like, say who was us and who was them. Mm-hmm. And he saw the Poles and the Russians as basically,
and Gypsies and Jews and the French and, yeah, just, and that was the growing list. That was the problem with Hitler, was that, you know, and Buchanan's argument is that he didn't actually start, he didn't want to start the war. He didn't really want to start a war. He had to, because other people weren't letting him kill the people he thought were his paranoid enemies.
Right, and he didn't necessarily want to take over the world either. He just kind of wanted to have Europe in that sphere there, I believe, and that's why he went after Russia.
Sure, right, exactly, because that's the landmass that connects all of Europe and into Asia. Yeah, of course,
right.
That's why he'd want it.
And Ukraine was going to be the breadbasket.
Right, nutcase. And Buchanan's trying to put a smiley face on it. He's like the George Lucas to Hitler's Anakin Skywalker, as it were. I got to take a break. Thanks for the call. 1-800-STEP-12 is our number. I'm Hal Sparks, filling in for Stephanie Miller and Chris Lavoie, and of course Emmy Award winner Jim Ward, which is how we're going to have to refer to him. It's the Stephanie Miller Show.
Coming up after this commercial, I will be talking even louder.
It's the Stephanie Miller Show.
You figured, oh, here's a loser, you know, a deadbeat.
Well, aren't you?
Well, yeah.
Welcome back to the Stephanie Miller Show. I'm Hal Sparks, filling in for Steph and the Mooks while they're away on vacation. 1-800-STEPH-12 is our number. Chairman Barney Frank was supposed to be with us this morning, and he had to reschedule. So he will be on. They're trying to reschedule him for next week, so he will be on with Stephanie, hopefully later in next week. Tomorrow, big show. John Farmer from he's a senior counsel to the 9/11 Commission. A big book on the true story behind the 9/11 Commission. Very exciting for those of you who are interested in that, much like I am. I think it's the one show this week Jim will listen to. Congressman Joe Sestak, who's running against Arlen Specter for Senate, it looks like, in the Democratic primary, which will be very exciting. John Fugelsang will be with us. And a special guest, Henry Rollins, will be with us tomorrow. So very exciting, a very outspoken day. I want to go to a couple of these calls. John in Ferndale, Washington. John, you there?
Hi, Hal. Hi.
Hi.
I was wondering, you know, Joe Scarborough, he was, I wonder if he ever went to C Street. when him and Pat Buchanan get together, their forces of stupidity just grow. But this morning on the Morning Joe, they're talking about the economy and how men are losing their jobs, but they're keeping women because it's economically feasible, because women still don't get a fair day's, you know, pay for a fair day's work.
Right.
So economically. And Joe Scarborough's doing the Chevy Chase, Jane Curtin weekend update thing behind her, like,
making faces while she speaks, right.
Mika Brzezinski, right. You know, she is the give her props.
Yeah.
I mean, come on.
Yeah. He's amazing in that I think they basically said, look, we're going to give you a morning show, but lighten up a little bit because the Fox thing is not working on our network. And it's not really at home here. And then occasionally he throws in like these little gems of foxiness that he likes. Like the other day we were talking about the healthcare debate, and he's going, here we come into the flu season. We still don't have a vaccine for swine flu that's fully tested and stuff. And you want the government to run healthcare? You're like, idiot. How do those two things correlate at all? A shifting virus, and we're trying to find a vaccine for it. It's like arguing that that the medical system doesn't work at all because polio took more than 6 weeks to figure out. It's moronic, and he does that quite often.
That Jonas Salk was such a slacker. Hey,
seriously,
can I just coin the phrase Emmy award winning mook?
Yeah, I think
right
that's
now?
You may have.
Okay.
Well done. Thank you so much for the call. Let's see. I want to talk to Karen in Sacramento because she wanted to talk about the MoveOn.org vigils last night for healthcare.
Hey, thanks to you
and your caller, we had the best health care vigil ever last night.
Fantastic.
We had over 100 people, and we sang Irish Eyes Are Smiling, and the media was there. And we got to educate people. There are at least 9 issues under the umbrella of health care reform, and I Twittered that link to your account.
Oh, yes, I saw that, actually, this morning, yes. And for those of you, I'll retweet that once I'm off the air. I'm at Hal Sparks on Twitter, and we've been pushing a lot of this info. Thank you so much for that. And you were there, correct?
Oh, yes? Absolutely. We had fun, too, and everybody had a beautiful candle.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for the call, and thank you for keeping us updated on it as well. And believe me, this is not the end of it. There'll be more of that needed, I think, as the debate goes on. Because once these bills get out of committee and Obama has given his kind of direction of what he wants, there's also going to be, debate on which bill and which parts of which bill get put together. So you need to let your congressperson know and your senator know what is really important to you. And Mike in L.A. will tell you how to find rallies.
Yeah, Hal, first just let me say you're doing a great job.
Thank you. Oh, I appreciate that. I'm trying very hard. It's a fascinating thing to do it by yourself. I understand why Steph has the MOOCs. They're very useful in circumstances like this.
But everybody can go to the Organizing for America website and find an event in their area.
Organizingforamerica.com?
You can Google it and
yes,
You'll get there. In Los Angeles, today at 5 p.m. at Cornfield Park, 1245 North Spring, about a dozen blocks north of City Hall, will be our rally. So everybody be there.
Terrific. And that's, by the way, Organizing for America. You can go just to BarackObama.com,
right,
and it will take you directly to that link because and there's a lot of resources there as well. I think it's fantastic that, and thank you for the call. I think it's fascinating that he took what his campaign arm was and went, let's try to make this useful the entire time I'm in, not to just campaign, but to actually get the ideas out and do that kind of stuff. And of course, Glenn Beck and stuff thinks that means he's forming his own private army, which is what you would do with the internet. Because that's my big fear personally, is that eHarmony is actually doing the exact same thing, that they're trying to get an army of old horny people together. In pairs to get them on some sort of space arc. I think I've been watching too much Glenn Beck, or not enough. I don't know. Quit. Oh, we'll decide in a little bit or whatever. Kevin in Washington D.C. wants to talk about Buchanan and his op-ed on slavery.
Yeah. Hey, Hal, doing a good job.
Thank you.
Yeah, to give a vote for him being the craziest, among other things he's done, was that he did a impassioned opinion that black people should be happy, should be thankful for slavery.
Right.
I mean, because, among other things, he brought blacks to Jesus. Now, of course, the inconvenient things like losing the language and the religion and the family and losing millions on the Middle Passage alone wasn't pleasant, but hey.
Yeah, you can't make an omelet without breaking some eggs, right?
Exactly.
You know?
And they didn't want to be taken, and they didn't want to be brutalized, and didn't want to have,
sure,
now have to fight tooth and nail for basic human rights, but, you know.
Sure. Well, you could follow the same Pat Buchanan logic to say that the Jews should be thankful for the Holocaust because they got Israel out of it as a state.
Hey.
Every cloud has a silver lining, according to Pat Buchanan, and even slavery and genocide.
Ken, did you see his performance with Rachel Maddow?
Oh, yeah.
White people have done incredible things. It's absolutely true. But according to him, they did everything.
They did all of it. Right. Exactly. And that none of it would have been done had it not been for them. Especially the white women even wouldn't have done.
Right.
It wouldn't have, never would have come up with this on their own if there was equality back then. It was just the natural smarts of old white guys that really made him.
He conveniently left out. That wasn't true that they did everything. But even if they had, he left out that, other people, women, people of color and so on, were forced not to be able to participate.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, exactly. So you wouldn't have even gotten, it may have even been a better system, but in his argument, it would have been worse because that's all we do is screw things up. But thank you so much for the call. I appreciate it. I got just a couple minutes left in the show. I want to go to, I just got a few seconds, Richard in Detroit. Richard, you there?
Great job, Al.
Thank you.
To my congressman's town hall on Monday. Thousands of people there. We couldn't even get in, so we stood out on the street holding up signs.
Uh-huh.
I've got a lot of conservative friends I can engage in and have a discussion. I just think they're misguided and misinformed. This is a totally different crowd, those people that were holding up flags to say, don't tread on me. And I sort of, when I get emotional, I think I develop a form of Tourette's syndrome.
Right.
And a woman was holding up a sign that said, Kennedy Care, just no for Mary Jo. And the man hadn't been in his grave 48 hours.
Right.
I kind of snapped a little bit, and I yelled something. And this old guy got up in my face. Are you familiar with Earl Weaver, the former Orioles manager? When he'd argue with an umpire, he'd turn his cap
sure.
around.
Right.
If we'd been wearing caps, we would have had to have turned them around. I said, what are you, like a century? You're out here, a century old? You're out here protesting government health care? You've got Medicare. And they were actually frightening. It's a different breed.
You're absolutely right. I gotta go because I'm running up against the end of the show. Thank you so much for the call. Be careful out there. A guy got his finger bit off at one of these events. I'm Al Sparks. I'm filling in for Steph all this week. Tomorrow, great show coming up. You can follow me at Al Sparks on Twitter. I'll Twitter those links that we talked about early on in the show. Go to StephanieMiller.com for the podcast. And, of course, you can find me on Facebook, Hal.Sparks. I have the little cartoon face because I like Jim Ward. Even though I haven't won an Emmy, I do cartoon voices. It's fun. And we will see you tomorrow. 1-800-STEP-12. Put it in your phone. I'm Hal Sparks, and you've been listening to The Stephanie Miller Show.